Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm Steve Hayes. I was joined this week by Chris Sununu, Governor of New Hampshire, for a fun and engaging conversation on a variety of topics. We talked about the idiosyncrasies and charms of New Hampshire in governance and politics. We talked about his wins and losses during his tenure as governor. I asked him whether the Republican Party is a friendly place for a limited government conservative like Sununu, given what we've seen over the past several years. We discussed New Hampshire's first in the nation primary and the role it will likely play in 2024. And we discussed his sort of open contemplation of a presidential run and whether he was serious when he called Donald Trump effing crazy during a dinner in Washington last spring. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Governor Sununu, great to have you. Nice to have you in the very fancy Dispatch Podcast offices, and good to sit across the table from you for this conversation.
Washington, D.C., my favorite place on earth.
Now, I'm not very good at picking up on the obvious, but I think you were being sarcastic there.
I just got off the airplane, and already I need a shower.
This is a good place to start. Let me start there. You spent some time here. You grew up here. You went to high school outside of D.C., Thomas Jefferson High School, very prestigious high school, well-regarded, often ranked the best high school in the country. It's been in the news a bit lately.
It has.
Have you followed this controversy?
Oh, yeah.
So this is the school where administrators didn't give a heads up to National Merit commendees and triggered this investigation, which has led to the discovery of a lot of schools not having done that. Have you followed it? Are you surprised that this is happening?
I'm following it. A lot of my former classmates are, you know, we kind of chat about it. We still stay in contact a bit. From what I've read and from what I understand, it's an absolute disaster. The fact that it's not just a high school. If you're withholding test information or merit information from a student, that in itself is deplorable. But the whole purpose of this high school is, I mean, it's really a high school of nerds, right? Let's just kind of own what it is. It's like a little MIT. And so, you know, that stuff is really important to a lot of these students. They put so much effort and so much into that. And to think that you would have a principal or whoever was behind it holding back results as their own responsibility to have an equity of outcomes, right? This country is not based on equity of outcomes. This country is based on equity of opportunity. And if that's the way it all really bears out, I think they're doing a whole investigation. It's just, it's absolutely crazy. And as a parent, I have two teenagers in high school right now. If I found out that for some reason the merit results of my teenagers were being withheld from them and me to basically hold my kids back because we have to make everybody on the same playing field, it's beyond just getting fired, right? It's really, you got to kind of have a bit of an upheaval of the entire system and say, what are we doing? What is the training going on within the Fairfax County system that would drive that? It's a public school.
Yeah, I mean, it has real world implications for these kids. I mean, they work hard. They achieve this thing, which is not easy to achieve. It's something that you use in college admissions. It will have potentially, I mean, now that it's been discovered, it might not, and they've retroactively scrambled to let the kids.
But what if they hadn't discovered it?
Right,
it really can have impact on where those kids go to college, what they major in, that first major step in adulthood and in their career path and their life path. It is life changing for those kids, and to think that one or two individuals behind the scenes are going to effectively hold kids back from their opportunities to equate outcomes, which, by the way, doesn't work, right? We all know that. Not only is it inappropriate and wrong in itself, but it doesn't work. And I come from the live free or die state, where individual liberty and freedom and opportunity is everything that we do. But you, again, we create the opportunity, not just the government, but our communities. But you have to kind of to drive through that. But you do it with transparency. You do it with lifting people up, not holding people back.
So you referred to Thomas Jefferson as sort of a nerd factory. You went from one nerd factory to another. You went to MIT.
You're an glutton for punishment.
Engineer by training.
Yeah.
You've run successful businesses. Presumably, given that background in engineering, you're sharp reasoning, logical. why would you choose to go into politics?
I know, right? I always said, and my wife asked me this all the time, because there was never a sense of going into politics, right? My dad was a former governor and White House chief of staff. My brother was in politics. But I also have seven brothers and sisters. So three of us have gone into politics. We're not a political family. By New Hampshire standards, that's nothing, right? In New Hampshire, everybody runs for office. That's just absolutely the way it is. So the two drivers for me were I had kids, and they started going through public schools, as I did, through New Hampshire. And we have great public schools in New Hampshire. But something wasn't the same. The Common Core stuff was happening. This was back around 2014 and 2015. This wasn't quite the public schools that I had grown up in. And I was getting complaints from teachers, when we were talking about it. At the same time, I was running my own business. I put an investment group together. I ran a resort, Waterville Valley Resort, and my family is still involved in it. I've since pulled myself away. But I was the chairman, CEO, general manager on the ground every day. And I was in the live free or die state, but there were all these massive state regulations bearing down. And I worked very hard to follow every rule. And I thought, man, if I have to struggle this hard to fill out all these forms and go through these review processes that just seem mundane and pointless, what does a little guy do, right? You know, because
In New Hampshire.
In the live free or die state. I said, this is just not right. So what I realized had happened was every year, it's creep, right? Government creep, a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit there. And after 20 years of basically Democrat governors, we hadn't had a Republican governor except for one two-year term in 20 years. We had kind of become like everybody else, but we're not. We are so different. And I'm really proud since I've become governor in the past 6 years. We're the diamond in the rough up in the Northeast. We're the red state. We champion our individual freedoms. We manage COVID better than anyone. We stayed open. We stayed flexible. We did it in a reasonable way. We didn't ignore the virus at all. We just put reason and common sense and transparency to everything, and it's worked out well. Strongest economy, only state in the Northeast that's actually growing in population. So we have all these wonderful metrics now. Still a lot of challenges. No, don't get me wrong. But we've really been able to put the teams in place, the metrics, and most important, the sense of accountability. That we're in government. We have to get something done, right? I'm not putting my family through all this public scrutiny to not get anything done. It boggles my mind that so many people are willing to do that. And I've had Republicans run my legislature. I've had Democrats run my legislature. We always find a way to do it. We always cut taxes. We always get rid of a little more regulation every year. And we're always creating opportunities. So I love it. And I love my job. I'm not going to lie to you. I really love it. So
you're at the beginning of your fourth two-year term.
Fourth two-year term.
And you talk about these accomplishments. What's your single proudest accomplishment on a policy level over that time?
Yeah.
What have you done?
That's a tough one. So I got to tell you, we talked about school choice in New Hampshire for 40 years. I got it done. I was told that we don't have sales tax. We don't have income tax. But we did have this pesky thing called interest and dividends tax. And even Republicans said, you can never get rid of it. Guess what? It's going away. It's gone. It'll be gone. And we're rolling it out. I passed a law to actually get rid of that. So, but then overall, if I might, I was most proud of my team over COVID. I really was. Because everyone disappeared. Legislature disappears. Everyone disappears. Most of the government all disappears. It's basically the White House and 50 governors. And to the White House's credit at the time, we had former Vice President Pence, who had been a governor. And he is the one that probably doesn't get nearly enough credit as he deserves in making sure the White House let states do it as the states wanted to do it, right? It wasn't, here's the CARES Act money and here's the 10,000 pages of rules you have to follow. It's, look, here's the guidelines. You guys got to help, you know, really figure this out, because what is good for New Hampshire might be different than Arizona or New York or even Massachusetts. And because of that, we were able to really shine. And I say we because it really was a team effort. And it was my team, I think, that had to take, you know, I mean, I could write a whole book on those first early days of COVID. But I said, look, guys, whatever this goes, because we don't know what's going to happen, I'm probably done politically, right? Let's just accept that I'll never get elected again, because I realized early on I was going to have to make decisions that got everybody upset. I just assumed that that would eventually happen.
With respect to the vaccines, with respect to mandates.
Well, we didn't even know closures. There were vaccines at the time. This is back in March. We didn't know if there'd ever
right
be a vaccine.
When you first
right?
heard,
yeah.
yeah.
So I said, you know, there are some people, it was clear that some people wanted complete shutdowns, right? Lock-in orders and all that kind of, which we obviously weren't going to. And some people wanted to ignore it completely, which we weren't going to do that either. So we were going to have to walk a fine line, which means everybody was going to get upset with us. At the end of the day, we did it really well. Our secret sauce, if you will, was I made sure that every time we made a decision, we brought the business community in. Restaurants would come to us and say, look, we want to stay open. I said, great, stay open. And they said, but we want our customers to feel safe. So let's work on some guidelines together so the customers feel safe, like we're acknowledging it, but they still know that they can come in and we can stay open, still make money. And that's what we did. So we did it with hair salons, and then we did it with car dealers, and we let them, not the government, we let them design their own successes through the COVID pandemic. It was a massive amount of work. We were kind of standing on our own on it, and it really worked. And so overall, I'd say how we handled that in its entirety, also the transparency piece, that was the most important thing. Through a crisis, you have to maintain public trust, right? Because and by the way, the White House was terrible at that at the time, right? And Fauci and all that kind of nonsense. But then the guys, governors, we had to stand up and say, look, this is the data we're seeing. And I would show, I'm a nerd. So I'd show my data, I'd show the trends and why. This is the decision we're making, and here's the data that's supporting that decision. And I would stand up there and I would let the press ask any question they wanted until they had nothing left to answer.
That could be dangerous.
Every day. Very dangerous. I went on live TV. This is another one. My staff was like, don't do this. But I said, we got to be transparent. We got to own everything. So I went on live TV on WMUR in New Hampshire a few times, like once a week. And they would just shoot at me questions off of Facebook, like just the most sane and to the crazy questions, things we had answered or not answered. And sometimes I'd have to say, that's a great question. I don't know. And then the next day at the press conference, I'd come back and say, I was asked this and here's the answer. So you just have to own, we can say we're all in it together, or you can make sure that the community really understands we are all in it together. So that was a very unique way of governing. I loved it. It was a great example, I think, of how to do it and how to manage a crisis. And yeah, probably one of my more proud moments that we really came through it well.
So you mentioned also school choice, the educational freedom accounts in New Hampshire. Certainly we've seen lots of progress on school choice, for those of us who believe in school choice, lots of progress nationally over the past few years. The educational freedom accounts pay for or are available to families, children and families earning 300% of the poverty level.
Yep.
That's not everybody.
No.
Are you prepared to push?
Yeah.
To broaden it?
We can.
Is that a priority for this?
I can tell you I'm going to have a budget presentation in about 2 weeks, and we're going to look into broadening it. So, for years they tried to do just the kind of voucher program and school choice for everyone. And I said, look, guys, let's get in the door. Let's prove the model that it works, and let's focus on those that have the least access to school choice. Low-income families, right? A lot of them are inner-city families. A lot of them are families that have never even been asked, what do you want for your kids? And we're going to change that paradigm. And we did. Really exciting. So we started at 300% of the federal poverty level. A massive number of families took advantage, way more than we thought. Very successful program. And we'll broaden it. If I say, look, we're just going to make it available for everyone, that'll never pass, right? So the amazing, and we can talk about this in a minute, the amazing aspect of my legislature right now, I have 400 members in my House of Representatives.
Right.
400, the third largest parliamentary body.
It's pretty evenly split, too.
200, it's 201 to 199.
Yeah,
it's crazy. So nothing too extreme is going to get passed, but we can get stuff done. And so, yeah, I'm going to propose an expansion of the program because it's been so successful. And there's so many families that again, just were never told and never offered that they had a choice. And now they're taking advantage, which is really exciting.
When you look around, you spent a lot of time talking to other governors, your colleagues, Republicans and Democrats. When you look around and survey what other governors have been able to accomplish, is there anything that you look at from another governor and you say, I wish I could do that?
Yeah.
Or this has been successful. I'm jealous.
So let's just start with school choice, right? So I look back what Jeb Bush did with school choice back in Florida. I look at what Doug Ducey did. He really expanded it in Arizona. He did a great job. Even in West Virginia, they did a really good job, expanding school choice. And we've looked at some of those models. It's funny. At least with the Republican governors, all the governors get along very well, generally speaking, compared to what you see in Congress, right? There's a lot of bipartisanship because we're not at each other's throats. We're really trying to, if anything, there's a friendly competition. And especially amongst Republican governors, I mean, I love working with those. Those men and women are incredible. And that's my team. That's one of the main reasons I didn't want to run for the U.S. Senate, because I knew I wasn't going to get a team like that again. If I needed a healthcare question, I'd call Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. That was his background, right? If I needed a question on energy, I'd call Doug Burgum from North Dakota or Mark out in Wyoming. We talk about mining and minerals. I'd call Spencer out in Utah. So I think everyone understands where they have their expertise, if you will. I don't know what my expertise is. Maybe individual liberty, freedom, and really good government. The number one question I get is, wait, you keep saying you have no income tax, you have no sales tax. How is that possible? right? And we're ranked as the most efficient government in the country. And we're, that's really one of the best rankings I can think of, that you get the biggest bang for your buck for the few tax dollars you put in. So when we talk about efficiency of government and kind of getting back to local control and what I think is the best government, which is not a top-heavy government, not a heavy hand from the top, that's probably where we'd come in a little bit. You know, there are some governments that are great on education, and we've tried to I got to really change my education formula in New Hampshire. You know, over across the country, one of the dynamics, it's going to hit everybody soon, really, except for maybe a few states in the South, but there's Gen Z is having less kids later in life, which means our schools don't have as many kids in them, right? And that is going to continue to decline, which means a lot of the funding models that are based on number of students in the classroom are going to start kind of collapsing, if you will. So you're going to have schools going, wait, I keep losing money. Well, because you lost 5 more kids this year and 10 more kids next year. How do you create more sustainable models? I'm not a believer that, those that say, well, if you just put more money into education, you'll get better results. No, wrong, not the case. But obviously you do need some core, base. There is a fixed cost to keeping the lights on in the classroom. And so you got to make sure you're maintaining that. And you're also being enticing and an attractive place for teachers to come to, not just because of pay, but because it's a place they want to work. They feel like they have a voice. So really stretching on that. So every governor kind of has their specialty. Some Democrat governors do as well. Gina Raimondo isn't a good one from Rhode Island, former governor of Rhode Island. We worked together quite a bit. Straight shooter to work with.
Would you have been happy to call Carrie Lake and ask her sort of what she would have done? Where would you have sought advice from her?
I never met Carrie Lake.
Doug Mastriano.
I never met him.
So we'll use that as our transition into some politics.
Into what?
Into some politics.
Okay.
Well, we could do into crazy.
Doug Mastriano is now our transition into the abyss. The transition into what not to do.
Wouldn't be the first time he served that role.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from Tax Network USA. Do you owe back taxes? Pandemic relief is now over. Along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. Don't waive your rights and speak with them on your own. They are not your friends. Tax Network USA, a trusted tax relief firm, has saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best possible deal. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help you. Whether it's business or personal taxes, even if you have the means to pay or you are on a fixed income, they can help financially resolve your tax burdens once and for all. Call 1-800-245-6000 for a private, free consultation or visit tnusa.com/dispatch.
You've been pretty open about the fact that you're thinking about running for president, which is... That doesn't happen all the time. I mean, a lot of people play sort of coy. You haven't been.
Yeah. Well, look, maybe it was the COVID thing. I don't know what it was, but I really, you asked me a question. I'm going to give you a straight answer. I'm not here to couch my words. I'll be for the most part, as polite as I can be. My wife reminds me I'm not nearly as funny as I think I am. I don't think any politician is. But, I'm just going to give you a straight answer. And so the straight answer is, yeah, of course. Yeah, people are talking about it. So, of course, we're having those conversations as well. But I would never get into a race like that unless, A, I really thought we could move the dial. Obviously, we'd want a chance to win. A lot of folks get in and run because they want to be vice president. They run because they want to sell their book, which are mostly god-awful, by the way. Have you read politicians' books?
Too many of them.
Yeah, dry as...
You're not writing one then?
If I wrote a book, it would be I would make sure it was really good. I'd probably write a funny book more than anything on the hypocrisy of government that I'm witnessing all over the country, the hypocrisy of bad policies on both sides of the aisle. But we're definitely talking about it. But my biggest concern and the reason I'm doing a lot of national stuff lately is, A, I don't know, it just seems like a lot of these would-be candidates are so try to be so coy about everything. It's like, come on, guys, they're all my friends. Nikki Haley and Pompeo and Pence, these guys are all really good people and they're all my friends. And as kind of the referee of the First in the Nation primary, I do have a responsibility and an opportunity to make sure that we do it right. It's not just about how much money you raise or your name ID. You better get in the room and shake some hands and look some people in the eye, because that's what good government's all about. That's localizing your policies. That's listening to someone and saying, look, you have all these great ideas up here at 30,000 feet, but at the end of the day, my kid's struggling in his classroom. Oh, okay. Not that the government not that a governor just solves that by waving a magic wand, but understanding what those issues are, and then hopefully creating policies that create those opportunities for that family. Not telling them what they have to do or where they have to go, but look, my job is to create as many doors of opportunity as possible. I'm not here. I'm the governor, and I am not, I'm telling you, I ain't here to solve your problems. The government is not here to solve your problems. We are really here to create those opportunities. Now, when you get at that grassroots level and you campaign at that level, great stuff can happen and real conversation can happen. And if I can drive that, all the better. Because I think these candidates have to be better.
Let me jump in on a policy level, actually. That's an interesting point. You said government is not here to solve your problems. There are echoes of Ronald Reagan, certainly, in that. But that hasn't been, I would argue, the main argument from national Republicans over the past 7-8 years. I mean, you look around, and certainly at the federal level, it's hard to find a limited government
party. I know. It's disappointing. And I'm not giving up on it. I just – look, people say all the time, well, the Republican Party didn't do as well in November of 22 as they should have done. So don't you need to change? No. We just got to remember what we are truly about. Get off the headlines. Get off the political stunts. Get off the big government authoritarianism where I say, well, that guy doesn't agree with me, so I'm going to pound down on him. Hold it, guys. We are about limited government, local control, individual responsibility, low taxes. Let's just start there.
Yeah.
That's 80, 90% of what we can all agree on.
Is it the case that
we agree 80,
90% of Republicans agree on
it's
that?
It's not sexy. It doesn't raise money.
I mean, it seems to me that the sort of big government Republicanism, the big government authoritarianism, to use your phrasing, is becoming more and more popular in a political culture where it seems as important or more important not to get policy results, but to go after the bad
guys.
It's
about the fight.
And to be disliked by the right people. How do you get past that? I mean, the people who are – look, I mean, this has been true in your primary endorsements, right? You've done very well in general election, popular governor, 60% approval. You haven't had as much success in your primary endorsements. I would say in part because of that exact dynamic.
Yeah, so, I mean, nationally, it's Republicans and Democrats – I think the core values of what we're about, we can agree on. But the process at which we get those results, we start fracturing because it becomes more about the fight. You can raise money on the fight. You can get a headline on the fight. Look, you're in fifth grade. You hear that there's going to be a fight after school underneath the jungle gym at 3 o'clock. Where is everybody at 3 o'clock underneath to watch the fight? And social media figured out this model early on, and they said, whoa, 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 let's let people have at it. Let's let people scream and fight and have it out because we're going to sell more of our product and we can advertise and make money. And a couple years later, mainstream media caught up and said, whoa, 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 why are we getting left behind? It's all about the fight. Yeah. It's not – nobody wants to –
But the Republican base to take your metaphor of another step would not want you to go and watch the fight. They would want you to go and be one of the combatants. Yeah. And their criticism of Republicans in days past, they were too polite. Yeah. They were fight watchers. We need a fighter. I mean, I would argue that's perhaps the main reason Donald Trump won.
Of course. Of course it is. He connected at a gut level with folks' anger.
And he was fighting about, in some cases, he was fighting on the other side of things that Republicans have argued for years in some cases.
You mean former Democrat Donald Trump?
Right.
Remember the days when, I mean, this is, remember when Donald, there was a day when Donald Trump was a Democrat and Bloomberg was a Republican, right? There was actually a day when that New York bizarro world existed. But now obviously the former president is just the quote unquote darling of the conservatives, but whether he really holds those values and everything is something totally different to be debated because to your point, and it's the right point, our anger, trumps everything. People enjoy the political stunts. Now, I hear people all the time say, oh, yeah, you know, we don't want big government telling us what to do. But yeah, when you know, whether it was DeSantis or Trump or whatever, you know, put their finger and put their thumb down on that town or that school board, wasn't that awesome? And I say, no. I mean, I might agree. I hate wokeism. I think this cancel culture stuff is terrible. But are we actually saying that conservative cancel culture is okay? That as
and
conservatives,
is that what,
we
is
can
that
do
what you
it?
See from DeSantis on some of these
No, not just Ron, but from
issues?
A lot of folks.
You've been critical of him in the past.
Well,
You've suggested that he is, in some ways, an avatar of this big
he's 2.0,
big government.
Right? Yeah. He's the new version, the 2.0, whatever it is. So, no, of course he is. And look, he's a good governor. I think people see me as critical of DeSantis because people ask me, and I'm happy to talk about it. I don't shy away, and I'm sure people are very critical of me. That's fine too. I love the constructive feedback. But at the end of the day, people want that fight over being reminded that that isn't what we're about. I might hate a company for what they're doing, their wokeism and all that kind of stuff. But if it is a private company with private employees and private share, who am I? I'm the government. Who am I to tell that company who they can hire and fire? I ran a company. I ran my own company for a long time. If the government ever came in and said, you should do this or shouldn't do this, or we're going to penalize you because we don't agree with you politically, because my big fear is this. I'm not worried about what happens in 24. I consider 48? I probably act like I'm 18. But I'm more worried about 28, 32, 2036, because if we're all about the fight, we're never going to expand our party. We're never going to get those Gen Z independents or Gen Z, what should be solid Republicans that are kind of Democrats right now. We are not opening ourselves up, and we don't have the leadership and the voice out there that's saying, hey, it ain't about attacking people. It's really about bringing people together. And I think the Republican Party has so much to offer, but we're missing the opportunity because we get excited by a headline for a couple days. So I'm just trying to be that, I don't want to say the voice of reason, but really that voice of optimism and hope. I understand there's a fight that has to happen, yeah, but I just think that's a short-term win.
Yeah.
I'm a Republican that is trying to build for the long-term strategy.
It's such a striking change. I mean, just talking to you and listening to you and having talked to you before, the optimism comes through. It doesn't feel forced.
No, I love it.
But in a way, it's like, that's not where the Republican Party is right now.
Well, I don't think that's where
it's
America
a grievance
is.
Party right out, now, no?
It's not just Republicans, though. Let's be fair.
Fair.
The Democrats are just as negative and dour. And you walk out your door, most of America is in an incredibly fortunate, blessed place right now. Let's wake up every day. Let's start every day, clap our hands and say, whoa, thank God I live in America. And I don't have to see my kids go off in a Ukrainian war or whatever it might be, right? Being scripted in Russia or deal with the craziness you see in parts of Africa or North Korea. I mean, there's horrors in this world. Doesn't mean we don't have our problems, but let's be blessed about our core of Americans first and be excited about it. And then build off of that optimism. I get excited about that. And if I can, you know, try to drive that message a little more, I think that there just needs to be, I'm not saying everyone has to agree with me politically, or you know, I'm not rainbows and unicorns either. I mean, this morning I was in the State House working on some insanely tough issues, you know, rebuilding mental health and working on our opioid challenge, which is a crisis across the country, dealing with immigration issues, which again is not a Texas issue, it is a 50-state crisis that Biden has blown it on. So we got to take our challenge on the problems. But there's so much economic opportunity right now. I mean, you know, we really are blessed. So let's grab onto those and then build from there, as opposed to saying, just like Democrats, this country is going to hell and capitalism and free markets don't work. You bet they work. They are everything. Nothing works but a free market. And that's me. I just try to be a principled free market conservative, and I'm trying to make sure people understand that that isn't just a couple words, that we live to that. And if I got to hold a few people accountable along the long way, so be it.
What, as you think about this, as you think about a possible run, what are the factors that will push you in one direction or another?
Yeah, well, again, I'm all about accountability and results. So if I think I can get the results that we're looking for, absolutely I'll do it. If I think that I'm just going to get in the way and be another candidate, then no. How's it going to affect my family? I'm a governor of a state. I'm not like some of these guys that just can spend 24/7 for the last couple of years running for president. My state comes first. New Hampshire comes first. The best part about being governor is I get to be super selfish. And by that, I mean, my job is to put the 1.4 million people of my state first every time without prejudice. And just try. I want all the other 49 states to look at New Hampshire under any circumstance and say, God dang, how are they doing it? How is that guy doing it? I love that. I love that sense of competition, designing systems, understand how they work from the ground up. It's one of my other big complaints. I think a lot of this negativity and the fight and all of that would dissipate if more politicians, more public servants would understand how these systems work. So I can't tell you how many people vote for things. And I have had conversations with U.S. senators, Republican and Democrat, congressmen, Republican and Democrat. When you say, well, you guys passed a law or a rule or funding that says X, Y, and Z, and they have no idea, literally no idea what you're talking
right,
about.
Right.
And it's like, wow, we have a mental health crisis. You don't even know how an average family accesses mental health, right? My job is to design that system ground up, empower that local control. So parents feel empowered with what, go back to what we started with, those doors of opportunity. A mom is in a mental health crisis. Her son is having issues, whatever it is. I want every mom to know, what is my first two steps that I can take? Because you're not thinking straight, right? In a mental health crisis, you're panicked. It's a family issue. There's stigma around it. What do I do next? Maybe it'll go away on its own. But I want every family to know what to do. Or if there's an opioid crisis, or if there's a healthcare crisis, or if there's a pandemic, or if there's a question about, what their choices are for school. I just want every citizen to understand their options. But I only know that, and I can only create that if I understand how those systems right. work ground up. These guys in Washington are a joke when it comes to that.
Well, you look at the disconnect between, I think, governors and other elected officials at the state level and politicians in Washington, and one of the most obvious places is on debt and deficits, right? I mean,
they don't know.
We've seen this sort of orgy of spending, certainly under the Biden administration, first couple of years of the Trump administration, well before COVID.
Oh, yeah.
Donald Trump was spending more than Barack Obama.
Were you surprised in those by that, though?
Not at all.
Not at all. That was his history.
But this was this is, I guess, what goes back to the question we were talking about just a moment ago. I mean, where are the fiscal conservatives? Right now, we're having this we're seeing a potential fight over the debt ceiling. And what you're hearing from many Republicans who want to make this a fight, and I'm an enthusiastic combatant if it comes to restraining the size and scope of government, but you've got to actually get at the stuff that's causing the problem in the first place, and that is entitlements. That's driving our national debt. Would you look at reforming entitlements? Would that be part of what you would run on? It's, supposed third rail of American politics.
No. Everyone panics about, you have to reform entitlements or not reform them. They're missing a couple of huge pieces. So let me take a one step back, because you're absolutely right that so few people in Washington have any sense of any of this. I won't say who it was, but I'll tell you, when I was thinking about running for the U.S. Senate, right, and for the 22 election, and all these senators are calling me, and I was actually out at a conference and I was sitting with one U.S. senator who I know fairly well. And I said, look, just explain this to me. Why doesn't one Republican senator stand up and just try, say, here's a first start at a balanced budget, right? Well, it'll never pass. Well, have the discussion. Force the vote. See what will work and what won't. Get the easy stuff done. But they won't even have the discussion. And they make it like that it is absolutely impossible to do. No, governor, you just can't do it that way. And I get ticked off as a governor. I have to balance my budget every 2 years. And every 2 years, I cut taxes. And every 2 years, I have a surplus, right? And that creates more opportunity to do new things and all that. And there's no sense of that. And I had a Republican U.S. senator, a very high-ranking member of the U.S. Senate, tell me, balancing budgets just isn't that important because the American public doesn't care. And I went, I got really ticked off. And I won't say exactly what I said, but I'll summarize
it. You can say exactly what you said. You're welcome to tell us who it was, too. Doesn't this go back to the authenticity point that you were—
Look, I'm not here to throw people under the bus, but he lives in town. So, but I got really upset. And I said, you don't get it. I said— Well, if we did these types of reforms, then we would be killed politically. And I said, no. I said, you're such cowards. People will stand up and champion you for doing things that haven't been done before. Even it might not be in their interest, and they may not agree with every policy or change that you made. They'll understand. They'll say, look, finally, I have to balance my home budget. My business has to balance its budget. And finally, the government is standing up and saying the same thing. Does it need massive entitlement reform? No. You know what the key is? The 10th Amendment. States' rights. We are a republic. Send it back to the states. You can cut massive amounts of and create massive amounts of saving, cut massive amounts of spending by sending effectively bigger block grants back to the states and letting the states decide what to do. The amount of bureaucracy that gets caught up in this stuff, the rules, all of these things that then translate to bigger costs on states and localities because now we have to follow your inane rules. Because Washington still has a mentality of one size fits all, as opposed to saying, look, what's best for New Hampshire is not necessarily what's best for anybody else and vice versa. So if you send it back to the states, you create massive amounts of efficiency. You can maintain pretty much all of the entitlements. You really can. I mean, you might have to create reforms way down the road for new members coming in, but you don't need to change anybody's entitlements for those that are currently in the system. And it's the again, look at all the discretionary spending. We just spent this $1.7 trillion bill. I ask everyone to go. I have a whole list of it. Every state, you should see the pork that is in that bill. Yeah. It is out of control
stuff. Just on a relative basis, yeah. Discretionary spending in pork is just nothing compared to Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the debt. Social Security is sort of its own problem. If you wait to make reforms so that they don't affect people in the current system, don't you risk not attacking with the urgency that it requires? I mean, you read the trustees' reports. They're sounding the alarms
as loud
as they possibly can.
These things are going to go bankrupt.
And it is the case. I mean, yeah. I think the challenge for so many Republicans is these are popular programs. People don't want them cut unless you make an argument, unless you try to persuade people.
And, you know, I think a lot of folks see George W. went out in 2005, I think, right, with a lot of Social Security reform ideas and all that, and just got pounded. I went back and looked at that. He got pounded less by the public and more by his own part and more by just the politicians that said, please don't do this. We don't want to stand up and make the argument. So I don't think you need mass. I really don't think you need massive entitlement reform because we will continue to grow. We are going to have a strong economy. Inflation gets under control, and I could rail on the Treasury and who should be fired at the Treasury, starting with Janet Yellen, and go right down the line for what they did with inflation, because that very well could have been controlled. But let's start with leadership that understands fiscal responsibility. None of this is going to matter if you don't elect a president that actually understands and cares about balancing a budget.
Or even talks about it. I mean, this is the thing I think that's been missing. It's really not part of the conversation.
People don't want to make it part of the conversation. But
I
do.
It's extraordinary given that we're
unbelievable.
$31 trillion.
And we're Republicans. And we're fiscal conservatives first. So that's one of the reasons I'm trying to push and stay out there as hard as I can, because I think, you know, I was told we were going to get immigration reform in 17 and 18, and we had Republicans in the Senate, Republicans in the House, and a Republican president, we got nothing. Healthcare reform, got nothing. You know, balancing the budget, obviously got nothing. You know, debt management, we hired a guy who lives on debt and doesn't believe in debt management, you know, and knows how to take advantage of those systems. We could keep going down the line of all these things we should have gotten done. Would we be having the immigration crisis today if we had just done some of the reforms in 2017 and 2018, like Republicans said they were going to do?
Why don't those reforms happen? And we've been talking about comprehensive immigration reform for decades.
I got to be honest, that one I can't figure out, because you definitely have Republicans on one side and Democrats on another that would come together. Not on a whole bit, not on every last thing you want, but you put it all on the table. Like, this is what I do in Hampshire. Okay, here's the 10 things I want and the 10 things they want. In immigration, the first five on both sides are pretty understandable, right? Maybe their side doesn't want to build the wall. I think we should. I think you have to secure the wall. But their side wants other things that we want. And again, you give a little, you get a lot, and you negotiate it out. And if you can't get everything you want, don't put it on the bill. Take some of it out of the bill
I agree with that analysis on sort of top level. Doesn't your analysis depend on the assumption that they want to get it done? That it's not more useful as an issue?
No, I don't, who's winning on that issue right now?
I don't think you know who's winning? Republicans running in primaries and Democrats running in primaries.
In primaries.
Right.
And they can't close the deal in November.
They can run on that. They can win primaries.
Primaries and be losers in November. And that infuriates me that as a party, we keep nominating people that have no chance of winning in November. And if anything, you can disagree with my politics all you want, but please, can we all agree that none of this matters unless you win in November, right? None of it does. And if you're electing somebody who can't cross the line, then this is just it's futile. So I try to live by the example of we've gotten a lot done. I've gotten it with Republicans and Democrats. I get politically rewarded. It doesn't mean everyone agrees. Does every Democrat agree with what I'm doing in New Hampshire as a conservative? No, of course not. But they trust me. There's a sense of trust there. They know what I'm about. I'm super transparent. And when I said what I was going to do on school choice, which obviously the teachers union and a lot of the Democrats hate, it's exactly what I did, and I worked very hard to get. And when people said it couldn't get done, I didn't accept that. And again, are Democrats coming around to it? No, but it's less of an issue today than it was 2 years ago, and it'll be less of an issue 2 years from now. So you gotta learn to take the incremental wins with it, and then you build off of those wins.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from Aura. Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And I'll tell you, not only have I given this picture frame to all the moms in my life, but I'm an only child, and it's been really fun to see my friends with siblings give this frame to their moms, and it turned into a passive-aggressive war to see which siblings can upload more pictures of their children. The Aura app is so easy. You can sit there at the end of the day while you're watching TV and just upload a couple pictures from the day and really show your brother-in-law who's boss. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code DISPATCH at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Let me ask you about Trump.
Who?
You knew it was coming. So you gave this speech, the Gridiron Dinner, this appearance at the Gridiron Dinner last spring, and you said Trump is, quote, effing crazy, but you didn't clean it up
the
way that—
You don't tell the joke like I do.
The way that I did.
I feel like Michael Scott watching somebody not tell the joke the right way.
Tell it.
No, it was a very good joke. And look, it was a roast. That's what the Gridiron Dinner is.
Of course.
And it was, look, that was a very fun night. I made fun of Biden.
Really? Tell the joke.
No, I'm not going to tell the joke. No,
I think it's great.
The spontaneity of the moment. I'll tell you, this is why the joke went over so strong. Because I mean, it's a pretty liberal room. And I'm the one Republican that has to get up there. And I got the room, thinking I was going in a different direction. And you could have heard a pin drop. And then I dropped the punchline and the place roared, right? And it was kind of more of a shocking thing than anything. And also, I know the F word had never been used before in that. And I'm not a big, you know, I try not to, I'm the governor. I try not to use foul language, but it's a roast. And I made fun of my father right before that. I made fun of myself. I made fun of Biden. Jen Psaki was sitting right next to me. I was making fun of her and MSNBC. I made fun of everybody. And then I made fun of Trump. It's a roast. That's what you're supposed to do. And everyone had a good time with it. So it was great. But look, the other half of – no, he's not effing crazy, of course. But when it comes to the former president, I'm not pro-Trump. I'm not anti-Trump. I'm – like most Americans, I'm just moving on, right? I think he did some really good things. And I was very strong about standing up as president when he would do something that I agreed with. I'd say, this is terrific. The vaccine, the regulatory reform, the tax cuts, he did it. And he deserves all the credit in the world for doing that. But when he would stand up and say something that I disagreed with or, no, not the right tone, or it was insensitive or insulting, I would say that too.
Yeah.
These are just the ABCs.
But on the crazy question specifically, there was a second part to your joke. And you added, I've got it. I was not there. I'm not violating any confidences.
Like, don't worry, Governor. Whatever you I'm say not in the violating, stays in
I
the
read
iron.
This. I read this in a publicly available place. I'm not there. I'm not part of the off-the-record agreement. You said the press will often ask me if I think Donald Trump is crazy. And I'll say it this way. I don't think he's so crazy that you could put him in a mental institution. But I think if he were in one, he ain't getting out. So
that's
I think it's a pretty
line.
Good line.
I think
it's a pretty good line. I'm this laughter that you're hearing from me is genuine.
Yeah, it's funny.
Are you serious? Do you think that's real?
No, look. The former president, everyone knows he's got a very big ego and all of that sort of thing. And there's some narcissism in there, of course. And that's what kind of creates the funny parts of those types of jokes, right? Because, you know, everybody knows that there's no secret. He's pretty much all about himself and what he wants to do and, you know, what barriers are in front of him to achieve his goal. He's not the first politician to be like that. He's a quite loud about it. You know, one thing I'll say, would he take questions from MSNBC and CNN? Yeah, he would always take questions. I mean, that guy was not afraid.
That was part of how we learned that he actually is crazy. I mean, look at the things that he was arguing in the context of the election. Yeah. Like that.
Oh, well, that's a whole different thing. Now you get to the election.
That was
in January
crazy. 6th.
That,
right?
That gets way out.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
You look at the stuff he's talking about now. He wants to suspend the Constitution. That he can be reinstalled. I'm sorry. That is, to use your phrase, effing crazy.
Yeah.
Why not say that he's crazy?
Yeah. Well, I did.
But now,
in fact, I said it first.
But now, after touting yourself as authentic and as saying what you mean, you're walking it back.
Oh, I'm not walking anything back. It was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious. So look, I would never say something someone's crazy, like in a serious way. I think that's, I try to stay positive, man. I really do. And I'll poke jabs at people and they poke jabs at me and I'll make jokes and all that sort of thing. And obviously every good joke has some truth behind it, right? But you know what was amazing about, I mean, there's a lot of stories that came out of that Gridiron Night. But what was really amazing is for the days after, everyone was talking about it and that I made this joke. And all the significant, I'll say the significant political talking heads of the Republican Party were dead silent. They were all just watching what's going to happen.
Yeah.
What is Trump going to say? What, you know what Trump said to me about that? Nothing.
Oh, really?
No, I talked to him a few months ago. I talked to him in September. I was trying to get him to endorse a candidate running for the U.S. Senate in New Hampshire. We had a great conversation. It was great. He's never said anything negative about it. Look, what he thinks about it, I don't know. But I'll tell you, the guy does have a sense of humor. I mean, he's not completely humorless. Maybe with the media he is and all that, because it's a real fight with him. So, no, I don't know exactly what he thinks of the whole thing, but it was a funny joke.
So if he, I know you love hypotheticals. I know you love hypotheticals about Trump.
As an engineer, I do not like hypotheticals. I like to go on the record.
It'd be great to test this if we could. Sure. Maybe it wouldn't be great to test this if we could. But he runs. I mean, do you think he's a front runner right now in 2024?
Well, top two, it's him and DeSantis, right?
Right now.
And then there's just everybody else. But no, it's the two guys running that are clearly running for president are running for president.
Yeah. If Trump's the Republican nominee, do you support him?
If he's the nominee?
Yeah.
Yeah, I fully plan on supporting the Republican nominee. He's not going to be the nominee, though. I mean, that is a real hypothetical. It's
but
not
isn't that, happen. Isn't that, I mean, given right. your critiques of him over the past, isn't that, walk me through how you get there. If you think that, you know, if you've been as critical as he's been, if you've
let's look at the
joked and sort of half-joked that he's crazy.
Well, look at the alternative. No, look at the alternative. The alternative, do I agree with how he says things and all this kind of stuff and whatever? Look at, we're going down a path of like, not theoretical socialism, but the Democrats have been absolutely brilliant about how they've, I'll go to that next generation, the Gen Zs, the iGen, whatever you want to call it. They aren't advertised. Republicans are so bad because we advertise, and that's not how you do it. Democrats have been influencing, and not just influencing with traditional, we're talking left-wing, progressive, socialist stuff. We used to make jokes about socialism. I mean, can you imagine, you know, that guy's like a socialist. And if you even said that to someone like Obama, he would be like, that's crazy. You know, we don't want socialism. And now it's mainstream conversation, and they've done a brilliant job of getting us there. That is my fear. I'm scared of where we are today from a government standpoint. I'm very proud of our country. I think we have lived in the greatest country in the world and all this opportunity. But that is without a doubt going to erode. You can't be $31 trillion in debt. You can't have a mindset of bigger government all the time and government's here to solve your problems and all of that. And this generation, that's why I work so hard on the next generation, because I said to about 400, 500 kids came into the state house once. And there were these volunteers, and I said, let's just have an honest conversation. I introduced myself, and I said, can you guys explain to me how you're kind of the first, you know, young, up-and-coming generation that I've ever seen in American history that isn't saying, you know, fight the power, fight the man, fight the government, we're independent, we know better than you old, you know, boomers. You're actually saying, no, give us more taxes, more government. That's our answer. Mm-hmm. I said, can you explain that to me? Like, what do you guys, I'd love to know, what are you thinking? You know, why do you want bigger, why do you want more government?
What was their answer?
And the dead silence in the room. And then this young girl in the back goes, that's a good point. And again, I think the problem is we're living here at 30,000 feet with headlines, with emotion, as opposed to, you know, allowing ourselves and being an example as kind of adults and parents and, leaders in our community, forcing that next third and fourth level of discussion about, wait, what are we really talking about here? What are the repercussions of what you're talking about? I mean, just look at those polls. When you poll young people, what do you think of communism, right? And what is it, like 25% of young people say communism is probably a pretty good model. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, can we look at Russia?
And they're deeply skeptical today? Of capitalism, too. Right.
Deeply skeptical of capitalism and free markets. And folks like AOC can raise millions of dollars on this nonsense. And the most shocking part is we actually have a real-world example of communism, whether it's in Venezuela or whether you're seeing what's happening with Russia, you know, this dictatorship style, or what's happening in China. It's right there in front of us how bad these systems are, how oppressive they are to the individual, how they strip you of your rights and your voice. And But we're just
there's an historical answer. There's an historical answer now. We know. I know you got to run.
No, I'll sit here all day. I couldn't care less. This is awesome.
Want to get to...
I usually, if you want to bring in like rum and cokes,
actually,
in about 20 minutes, I will really open up.
We have some scotch on the floor here.
I just started drinking scotch, by the way. Well, scotch and whiskey.
Really?
It was never my thing.
And you like it now? Is that just an age thing?
I do.
Acquired taste?
Isn't that weird?
I can't drink scotch. I have a theory about scotch.
Well,
I've debated it. Jonah's a big scotch drinker. David French drinks scotch. I think nobody actually likes scotch.
I think it's
a thing because it tastes so terrible. I mean, the people who drink scotch obviously will come at me, but...
So I will tell you, I was right with you a year ago. I'm like a rum and coke guy. Just give me my kind of a sweet rum and coke, great, whatever. Gin and tonic, okay, fine. But regular scotch, I would never touch it. But I tasted really good scotch. And I had maybe two. I gave myself two or three of them.
Yeah.
And I started going, I get it. Now, I can't tell the difference, and I don't care about all that stuff. What is a 50-year, in a 12-year or whatever, McClellan? I don't even know. But I get it. It was pretty good. I like sipping on it. It was warm.
I mean, we have some.
It was warm.
We literally have some here.
And it was just a very easy drink to have, an easy drink to kind of carry around
Jameson
in my hand.
Black Barrel.
You know,
I should have. Oh, it's Irish whiskey.
And also, you know what else I like about it?
Beginning.
I drank it slowly, and I didn't mind drinking it slowly. I haven't. Look, I'm not so into it that I figured out whether do I like it on the rocks? Do I like it neat? I don't know. I'm not a very big drinker at all, by the way, at all. But no, I just started this thing. But I started with good stuff, and that kind of got me hooked.
So next time we do this, we'll do it in New Hampshire, and we can each bring a drink of choice, and then we'll have this.
So what's your anti-drink of choice? Like, what did you, if you don't mind me, what did you likely throw up on the first time you got drunk, and therefore you can never touch again?
So I don't,
right?
We
all have one of those.
I honestly don't have one of those. I'm not, I don't drink hard liquor, really. I drank some bourbon in college, and I still don't mind bourbon, but it's like three times a year.
Are you a beer guy?
Maybe. I grew up in Milwaukee.
Oh,
so
there you go.
I was definitely a beer guy growing up. But I can't. This is an old guy thing and probably way too much information to include in a podcast. I can't do it. My body just doesn't like beer anymore.
Really?
And it's painful because I love a good beer as much as the next guy. No, my thing is Spanish wine. I lived in Spain for a year. Yeah. And I think Spanish wine is
where do you live in Spain?
In Madrid.
Madrid. Yep. My wife lived in Cordoba down.
Cordoba.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful area. And she grew up in a Spanish-speaking town, so she speaks very fluent Spanish. But
I grew up in a Spanish-speaking town, and I do not speak.
Yeah. I'm not a wine guy, though. I lived in California. You know, I went to San Francisco for 3 years. We had never lived anywhere else. I was about to get married. My wife and I moved to San Francisco just to see what it was like, and it was beautiful. I mean, we spent all our money on rent and food.
Yeah,
and you could do that before we had kids.
Right.
But I tried to get into the whole Sonoma Napa thing. Not my jam.
Mm.
It's like
I would like to live out there.
Really?
for that reason.
Boy, I mean, it was you'd go out and you get guys and you'd be doing these tastings and you have these insanely wealthy people that you didn't know that had just bought like $1,000 bottles of wine and wanted to share it with you. It was insane. You know, we were like 20 somethings, and I would be drinking this wine, going, this could be $2 Chuck, and I couldn't tell the difference. I don't. It's all the same to me. I felt bad.
I've become a little bit of a snob. I hate to admit that. But
do you like hold your ear
wine,
when you smell the glass? Are you that guy?
I don't hold my ear. But no, I can taste the differences, and I know the grapes. And yeah, no,
I get notes of asparagus and pumpkin here.
Wet asphalt. let's end on New Hampshire. Let's end on First in the Nation. Really interesting stuff happening on the Democratic side right now. National Democrats don't want New Hampshire to go first. New Hampshire Democrats really want New Hampshire to go first. But interestingly, neither of the Democratic senators from New Hampshire are really doing much.
Shocking. They haven't done anything since they took off. So you're expecting them just to wake up now?
No. I teed you up for that, didn't I?
God.
But I mean, it's a 51-49 Senate. I mean, they could make some of President Biden's priorities
and
a challenge
should.
If they said, hey, we want you in New Hampshire.
Look, there are two Democrat senators sitting there. They have all the leverage in the world to say this ain't going to happen, and they're not using it. And they're like terrible used car salesmen. They don't know how to make a pitch. What has happened is this decision was going to be made to strip New Hampshire of the First Nation primary back in August. And then they delayed it because they thought Hassan might lose on it, which who knows what would have happened. So then they said, we're going to make the decision in November. They delayed. December, delayed. January, they delayed. Now they're saying we have till June. They asked me, the governor, the Republican governor, to send them a letter confirming that I would change my state law to conform with the National Democrat Party's demands. And I ever so politely told them to go screw. So this is their crisis, though. They're realizing the arguments we've made are quite valid. The fact that you have candidate Joe Biden saying, I'm going to take it from New Hampshire and bring it to South Carolina. Let's talk about South Carolina for a second. The voter turnout in South Carolina is 16%. New Hampshire sets records with our voter turnout. In 2020, they didn't even have a primary for Donald Trump. When you're the incumbent, they traditionally just anoint the elite. They don't have to have a primary. So Joe Biden has taken the First in the Nation primary from New Hampshire to move it to a state that will not even hold a First in the Nation primary. Why? It's just personal political payback to his buddies that resurrected his—
That was, you know, where he was reborn.
And
right?
Look, he went 100 days in
New
Hampshire.
And he didn't do— What did he get, 8% in New Hampshire?
Oh, he got crushed. Oh, yeah. He got on a plane at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Election Day and flew out of there because he knew he was— But he had earned that disastrous result because he wouldn't answer questions. He wouldn't be personal. He wouldn't look people in the eye, and they tried to protect him too much. And we don't—it doesn't fly. South Carolina, there, it's more about the political elites, and he was able to be successful there. So he's just rewarding them. Now, nationally, the Democrat National Committee is realizing, wait a minute, this goes quote-unquote, to South Carolina. What's going to happen? You think no one's challenging Joe Biden? Of course they are. There's no way some of these progressives are going to stay out of this race. The liberal, I've said this before, but I think it's a pretty good line. You know, I always say, what does the left-wing elite of Washington, D.C. say about Joe Biden behind his back? Exactly what they said to his face on the primary stage, that he was an old, out-of-touch white guy that didn't represent the future of the Democrat Party. You think they're going to let that guy sit there for 6 more years and run this? No way. They're not going to stand for it. New Hampshire's the opportunity. Biden says he's taking it to South Carolina. Believe you me, candidates on the Democrat side are coming to New Hampshire because we're going first. Whether they like it or not, our law says we are. The Republicans are going first in New Hampshire. So all these Democrat candidates are likely going to go. Then you're going to have a couple winners come out of, you know, the first or second place person comes out of New Hampshire on the Democrat Party. They have all this momentum. They have all the media. They have all the attention. Biden's on his heels. And you could potentially have progressive candidates run right by Joe Biden because he was so insistent on skipping New Hampshire. Point is this. It's going to be a great show. It's going to be a lot of drama on the Democrat
side. And what
about
the Republican side?
It's going to be, look, we crushed it last time. In 2020, both on the Democrat and Republican side, Iowa screwed up. Remember that whole debacle in Iowa? They were still trying to figure out who was winning. New Hampshire was up and the whole country was holding its breath going, wait, is this whole primary process, is it all screwed up? Can we trust this thing anymore? And to our state's credit, we worked really hard and we nailed it. Every vote was counted. We got a winner that night, the whole nine yards. A lot of integrity in the system. We moved forward and the whole country took a big sigh of relief that, oh, okay, we can do this, right? Not every system is screwed up. And so I think we've earned it. If you can get our voter turnout, if you can get our metrics of accessibility to the candidates, if you can get our metrics where it doesn't matter how much you're spending in advertising, you got to meet the citizens at their level and on their issues. That's the great first filter that everyone in America wants to see. They claim that South Carolina is more diverse than New Hampshire. What does diversity matter if only 16% of your population actually votes? What's the point of...
Don't you think more people will show up and vote if it's really the first? I mean, I would imagine that number
because would... because the elites still pick the winners. And by the way, again, in Joe Biden's case, they're just going to anoint him because he's the incumbent. They're not even going to hold a primary. That's because they just won't, especially if you will have other candidates come out of New Hampshire. If they have a head of steam and then they do the South Carolina vote and they let those other candidates on that ballot, they'll likely beat Joe Biden in a state that he thought he was the anointed winner of. So they're going to make sure Biden gets his win and they're going to go to the next state wherever that is. So there's a lot of drama there. They didn't think it out. They're trying to delay it all. But we're going to go first, no, regardless of what the National Democrat Party
on the Republican side, there was a poll out, University of New Hampshire poll this week, had Ron DeSantis at 42, Trump at 30. You were at 4. Liz Cheney was at 4. Larry Hogan was at 4. Is DeSantis the front runner? And
in New Hampshire, yeah, sure.
And how important is it for you if you decide to do this to win your own state?
Oh, if I decide to do this, if I don't win my state, I'm done. Look, people say that, if Sununu runs, he'll have an advantage in New Hampshire. Just the opposite.
Yeah, expectations would suggest.
That's right.
Because you have to win.
I have to win or I'm done. And by the way, even if I win, they'll be like, oh, he didn't win by enough.
It doesn't matter.
He only won by 12 points. Yeah. He should have won by 80. So no, there's actually a huge disadvantage to that, frankly. But The same goes for Nikki Haley and Tim Scott in South Carolina, another early state, or Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, Rubio, Scott, whoever else decides to run in Florida, right? So it's going to be those early states are going to kind of filter everybody out of this race. Now, DeSantis and Trump are really the only two people running, so obviously they're going to should do best in all the polls. I was shocked that I was even in a poll. That's kind of cool.
It was a New Hampshire poll.
It was. Well, look, I mean, people know me as governor. They know I emphasize a lot. My first attention is always on New Hampshire, of course, as governor. But we'll see. There's still a year. That's the other thing. People are like, oh, are you going to get in the race? You've got to decide now. And I'm like,
but debates are like, we're talking about August, the first September. Debate in July. Oh. July, August?
Maybe there'll be some candidates in the race by then, but I don't think everyone will be in the race by then. So how they determine who stands on that stage will be interesting. Remember, these folks have all been running for president for 2 years, and they're not announced candidates. When you announce as a candidate, all the rules change.
Everything changes.
And not for the better in terms of these big fundraisers. DeSantis is raising hundreds of millions of dollars, as is Trump. Trump is a candidate now, but DeSantis as a non-candidate is raising a lot of money in a 501c4s or whatever they do. There's just a long way to go. A lot more politics to be played here.
Well, Governor, thanks for playing some with us. Happy to have you
did
here.
Dispatch HQ. Did I earn a spot back?
And next time we'll be in New Hampshire, and we will maybe we'll do it over a glass of scotch and a glass of
Spanish wine,
red wine.
There you go. Thank you, man. This is a lot of fun.